it's Diane. On my mind, the Senate's impeachment trial of Donald Trump begins.
Mr. President, the managers on the part of the House of Representatives are present and ready to present the articles of impeachment, which have been preferred by the House of Representatives against Donald John Trump, President of the United States.
But as senators prepare to consider the two articles of impeachment, more details continue to emerge. Whether any of the new evidence will be part of the Senate trial is still a question. And if it would sway any senators, many of whom have already laid down their positions, is also unclear. To talk us through this historic moment, I spoke with Neil Katyal. He's the author of Impeach, The Case Against Donald Trump. Neil Katyal, let's talk about what we learned this week from Lev Parnas. You wrote that the new information from him demolishes Trump's defenses. Why do you say that?
You know, maybe to take a step back, I wrote this book called Impeach, which came out on November 26th, which is a kind of guide to the impeachment allegations and the history of impeachment and the like. And it's just a 150-page book that just kind of lays it out in simple terms. And at that point, the argument of the book was very simple, which is the president tried to cheat in the 2020 election and with the help of a foreign government. And that is the paradigmatic case for what impeachment's about. And all you need to know, as I said in the book, was read the transcript of the July 25th phone call. It's all there, because there the Ukrainian president says, I need this military assistance, Mr. President, these Javelin missiles. And the president says, well, wait, I need a favor from you first, though. And it's that though which is so problematic. And his defense afterwards has been, oh, no, I was legitimately trying to fight corruption. And that's what was going on. There have always been a few problems with that. Number one, the transcript has been edited to make it look like it's about corruption, but it was actually about Burisma, the individual company in Ukraine that the Bidens were associated with. Number two, the president was asked back then, did you ever care about corruption in any other country? Can you give us any example anywhere in your 3 years as president? And he couldn't. Number three, the Trump administration had recently certified Ukraine as free from corruption to the point where they could get the aid. So it was in this plan was in contravention to that. But number four, most importantly, as I know from two tours at the Justice Department, if you actually worried about corruption in a foreign government, you send Justice Department prosecutors and FBI agents there. You don't send your private attorney, and certainly not when your private attorney is Rudy Giuliani, of all people. So what the document dump did 2 days ago, Lev Parnas's information, is it had a couple of really important things in there. One was a letter from Giuliani to the president of Ukraine, in which he said, I need to meet with you about all this now, but please understand, I'm meeting with you not as the lawyer for the president of the United States, but as the lawyer for Donald Trump in his personal capacity. Now, if this was an official corruption investigation, that's obviously official United States business. But Giuliani himself characterized it as the opposite of that, as the president's personal business. So I think it really undercuts or really demolishes this idea that the president was acting to root out corruption. He was just trying to get dirt on his political opponent, and actually wasn't even dirt. And this is the other thing that the Parnas documents reveal. All Trump wanted was the announcement of investigation. He wanted to tar and feather Biden. He didn't actually care that the investigation happened. And that's also what the Parnas documents reveal. So to the extent anyone still thought this was about corruption, not anymore.
Lev Parnas told the New York Times that, as far as he knew or believed, that President Trump knew about everything that was going on. Now, aren't President Trump's defense lawyers going to tear that statement apart?
So Parnas has said this now several times in the last 48 hours, including Rachel Maddow. In fact, Maddow asked him, you know, why are you coming forward? And he said one central reason: the president lied. He said that he didn't know anything about what was going on. He obviously did. Now, I said that night, and I still believe, you know, this is new information. We have to get it tested and verified. And obviously Parnas has some credibility issues of his own since he's facing a federal indictment. And one of the things that he hasn't detailed is how he knew that the president knew. Is that just conjecture because of what Giuliani said, or does he have firsthand information about that? You know, we don't know. Obviously, there is already firsthand information that this was the president carrying out a scheme, because that's what the transcript says. But, you know, in any investigation, it's always helpful to have corroboration and live witnesses who can bring that episode to light. And so Parnas may be quite important as a vehicle for that story to be told to the American people.
Democrats, and specifically Nancy Pelosi, feel it is absolutely imperative for the Senate trial to include testimony and documents. Do you believe that's going to happen?
I do. I never heard of a trial, and you know, I've been around as a lawyer for a long time, I've never heard of a trial without documents and witnesses. And what the president is trying to do, have an impeachment trial by gagging every witness and every document, is literally unprecedented in our nation's history. We've had two impeachments of presidents before that have been tried in the Senate. Andrew Johnson in 1867, when 41 witnesses testified, and Bill Clinton, where three witnesses testified, and many, of course, testified in the House in the earlier Ken Starr investigation. We've never had something like this in which the president just on his own decides, hey, I don't need to bother doing that. It is a profound betrayal of his constitutional oath. And I am very optimistic that senators from both parties will put an end to that nonsense.
It's going to take at least four Republican senators to make that happen. So you are confident that that's going to happen?
I am. First of all, I think it, you know, technically maybe three, because there are 53 Republicans in the Senate, and a tied vote would then be broken by the Chief Justice. And indeed, it may be put to the Chief Justice first before it goes to a Senate vote. And indeed, I think that would be my preference. And I think the way that the Senate rules currently operate. And, you know, I've had the privilege of arguing 41 cases in front of our Chief Justice. And I think all Americans should be very confident that this man, John Roberts, will render impartial decisions based on the law. And I think it's very hard, you know, we'll see the arguments on both sides, but I think it's very hard for someone who knows anything about law to say, oh yeah, you can't have these really important witnesses in this incredibly important trial to the American people.
I am not clear on exactly how much of a role the Chief Justice is actually allowed to play. How much can he speak? Can he ask questions? What can he do to ensure fairness in the process?
Not only are you not clear on it, I don't think, you know, history or even scholars are. The Constitution does say that the Chief Justice will preside over the impeachment of a president, but it doesn't say more than that. And so we'd have to look to history and also the Senate rules. And there's a good argument that the Senate rules currently empower the Chief Justice to make these decisions on witnesses and the like. Of course, it could be rebuked by 51 senators and overturned, but that the Chief Justice should make them in the first instance. And I think that makes a lot of sense. After all, we are in a proceeding that has both legal and political elements to it. And I don't think we should allow the political elements to cut off at the get-go the legal elements. So I think, you know, having the Chief Justice decide these questions first would make a lot of sense. And then obviously, if the Senate wants to contemplate a reversal and a debate over that, an oral argument or whatever, they can do that.
Senator McConnell wants to leave the question of whether to call witnesses until later. What difference would that make if they were called sooner rather than later?
I think as a litigator, you always want to have a complete picture of the facts before the trial begins. So that's why we have things like depositions and the like, to avoid surprise testimony. And what we're trying to do, after all, is find a search for truth. And to me, the best way to find that search for truth is to have everyone know what everyone's basis of knowledge is beforehand, as opposed to in real time in surprise settings. And so I think it'd be unfortunate. I really don't understand. Well, I guess, you know, I do understand the sense. McConnell is just so afraid of the truth coming out that he's taking any steps he can to try and block it and block the witnesses. But that's a really unfortunate thing from the standpoint of the American people and the truth to emerge. I mean, I think we should let all the facts come out. And then if people want to say, look, we like President Trump, we like his economic policies or whatever, we don't want to remove him, fine, make that argument. But let's have all the facts come out first. Let's let the American people understand exactly what happened. And I understand that there are a lot of Republicans who think this is all a politically made up thing and the like. If so, that's the best argument for a trial. Let's have that all out. Let's have it all out there and have an actual argument after we know what the facts are, as opposed to the president just saying, oh, I don't need to bother complying with this part of our Constitution.
Who are the people you'd most like to hear from?
So obviously John Bolton, who said he wants to testify and is kind of in the room for many of these key decisions. Mick Mulvaney, the president's acting chief of staff, who was deeply involved in the aid cutoff as well, and at one point actually admitted that there was a quid pro quo. He said, yeah, this happens. Get over it. I'd like to see Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's now knee-deep in all these allegations about our ambassador to the Ukraine and whether she faced any threats or reprisals. And two other people. One is John Duffy, who was at the Office of Management and Budget and crucially involved in all of these decisions about Ukrainian aid. And then the last one, and the most important one, Donald Trump himself. The president has said he had a perfect call, a beautiful call. He did nothing wrong. If he so strongly believes that, he should go tell that to the American people under oath. This is not a trial in the House of Representatives, which is controlled by Democrats. This is a trial in the Senate, which is controlled by his own party, in which our founders said 2/3 of the Senate would need to vote to convict him. So this is as fair a proceeding as he could ever have. And if he's afraid to tell the truth in that, that silence of his, that action speaks volumes for what I think he knows he himself did.
But, Neil, what kind of leverage do Democrats have here? What if Republicans do want to call Hunter Biden or even the former vice president himself?
In some ways, that is rewarding bad action, because after all, the president started this whole thing just to tar and feather Joe Biden, and to be able to have an impeachment proceeding in which that happens is to reward the president's really egregious, unconstitutional behavior. On the other hand, it may be necessary in order for the truth to emerge. It may be that just all relevant witnesses have to come forth, not just the Bidens, but the Pompeos and Donald Trumps of the world as well. And from my perspective, I think what's going on here, the allegations against the president are so serious. They are at the heart of what our impeachment clause is all about. If it required the testimony of the Bidens in order to get that to happen, I think that would be a price to pay, but it would be a worthwhile price to pay.
What would you want to hear from Hunter Biden?
Nothing. I think it's irrelevant. I mean, you know, it's a joke. The idea that that's what was going on. It's a story that doesn't make any sense, that the president was actually concerned about legitimate corruption investigations going on there. So it's a sideshow and a distraction. But if that's what it takes in order to get the president to testify and these other people, I think it's worth considering.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and
Curiosities.
From the District.
Tacoma Park.
Alexandria.
Friendship Heights.
Hyattsville.
Falls Church.
Northeast Washington, D.C. in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Neil Katyal. He's the author of the book titled Impeach, The Case Against Donald Trump, and previously served as the acting Solicitor General of the United States. He's also a professor of law at Georgetown University. The president has now named the attorneys who will represent him, including Alan Dershowitz and Ken Starr. Tell me your reaction.
Well, I'm glad that the president is able to secure the counsel of his choice. That hasn't always been the case. I know that a lot of times lawyers have refused to work for him, but it sounds like he wanted to have Ken Starr and Professor Dershowitz, and he's got them. Both are distinguished members of the bar. I actually wrote a op-ed with Ken Starr last year, which I haven't had a chance to look at again, in which we did question some of President Trump's decisions and judgments. So I think it's an interesting choice.
Were you at all surprised that Ken Starr was one of his choices?
No, in the sense of if you are a president facing impeachment, one of the things you're going to look to is people who've been around impeachment proceedings before, and that's obviously a very small set of people. And, you know, I will tell you, just as someone who's defended the unpopular lots of times, including Osama bin Laden's driver, I think it's to be celebrated in our system that lawyers go and represent clients, including sometimes unpopular clients or controversial clients. So I have no issue whatsoever with Starr defending Trump or Professor Dershowitz defending Trump. I obviously think that they have a tough case ahead of them in terms of the actual facts and law as to what happened. But the president's certainly entitled to have a defense from these gentlemen if that's what he wants.
Republicans keep saying that this is the same as the Clinton impeachment, that they're going by the same rules and procedures. Is that a fair statement?
Not at all. It's a fair statement if you ignore all the witnesses and documents and investigation done of Bill Clinton first, and just pretend magically to look at the Senate. But even if you pretended magically to look at the Senate and the Senate trial, even there were three witnesses in the Senate trial of Bill Clinton, and Trump and McConnell are arguing for zero witnesses. So I think that's one problem. But the real fundamental difference is this. Bill Clinton did not try and gag every witness and every document from coming forward. No president in our history has ever done that. Richard Nixon thought about it for a couple of weeks, as I wrote about in the New York Times, but even he backed down. So it is a fundamentally different thing. There's no precedent. There's no prior instance of a president doing anything like what Donald Trump is doing. And you have to ask the question, why? Why would the president take this unprecedented step of a full blockade on all documents and witnesses, particularly when he claims he did nothing wrong and it was all perfect and beautiful? And I think the question answers itself. He himself doesn't even believe his defense.
You mentioned earlier the concerns regarding the former ambassador to Ukraine. What was going on there? Was there actually some kind of monitoring of her moves? Was there some actual threat against her life?
We don't know. I mean, these documents have just been revealed in the last couple of days. They do suggest some electronic surveillance was going on. They can be read to suggest some physical threats might have been contemplated. But again, you don't know if that's idle talk or what. But regardless, it's a really deeply worrisome thing. I mean, it looks much more like organized crime behavior than it does like from what I would expect from any U.S. government employees or folks who are working with U.S. government employees. I mean, it is scary stuff. but you know, the facts have to emerge. But just so that everyone, your listeners, are aware, why was this ambassador to Ukraine so important? So she's the United States' top representative, and Trump obviously wanted her out. And it looks like, from her own testimony, Trump wanted her out because she didn't believe in any of these bogus investigations. She was trying to stop them and trying to build a legitimate, real relationship with the government of Ukraine instead of the kind of transactional and toxic one that Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump were trying to create.
We also learned this week that the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, said the White House acted illegally when it withheld aid. Does this change anything?
I think it does. I think it's very significant. So the GAO is a nonpartisan part of our government that is charged with investigating government spending and the like. And what it found was that President Trump violated the Impoundment Control Act, which was set up after Nixon because Nixon had so abused the spending powers. And they said that this was a violation of that law, and that the president violated his oath to the Constitution and laws. And then, remarkably, it also went on to say that the White House had been stymieing their own investigation and suggested that there was an obstruction of justice there. And the very last paragraph says that this has real constitutional significance. And so what you really have is this nonpartisan agency siding with the House articles of impeachment, not just on the first article about the Ukrainian aid and the abuse of power, but also the second article about obstruction of the investigation, because the GAO says both of those things happened in their own study and investigation.
I want to go back for a moment to Mitch McConnell and the oath that each of these senators took yesterday from the Chief Justice, saying that they would judge impartially and fairly, with Mitch McConnell already stating that this was a, if you will, trumped-up case, and that he believed that the president would be cleared. Do you believe that he is going to, or is already negating, that oath of office and the oath that he took from the Supreme Court justice yesterday?
Well, that oath is a really important one, and it goes back to our Constitution and our framers, who really thought oaths had a significant role in our society, and that there were solemn moments in which you'd kind of change your ordinary daily behavior and commit to a certain set of principles. And, you know, McConnell, along with his 99 colleagues, took that oath yesterday. And if he does the same things today as he's been talking about before, no witnesses, trying to end this, try to have a show trial. Yeah, I think that would be in fundamental derogation of his oath to do impartial justice. And I think there's a very simple way that I teach my law students about this. You know, there are fancy terms like John Rawls, behind the veil of ignorance and the like. But the simplest way of thinking about what justice is about or impartial justice is to look to that statue of Lady Justice who's blindfolded. Why is she blindfolded? Because the idea is it doesn't matter who the parties are before you, the result should be the same. That's the essence of what law is. And so you ask yourself, if you're a senator, if President Obama did these things, was accused of doing these things, would I want a trial with no witnesses and no documents? It's just as simple as that, or a President Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, you know, however you want to pick it. But that's what impartial justice actually means, which is you take out the parties and the identities of them and you say, what are the right rules to apply? And I have to think, if McConnell looked in the mirror and in a moment of quiet reflection, to the extent he has any, and asked himself that question, there's no way that he could say, I would have a trial with no witnesses and no documents. It's just, it doesn't pass the laugh test.
But what about his saying that he is in direct touch with the president, that he is taking his lead from the White House? Why wouldn't the Supreme Court Chief Justice call him out on that?
Well, certainly he did say that, and even more a couple of weeks ago. He said he would march in total lockstep with the president, and at the end of the process, the president was definitely going to be acquitted. That is not something that the head of a tribunal that's to do impartial justice can say, at least not in this country. Maybe in Soviet Russia, it's different or something. So I do think that that's a really problematic statement. And if he said it again after he's taken his oath, I think he does absolutely, Mitch McConnell would deserve to be rebuked and to go down in history as a craven, unconstitutional creature, unworthy of service in our great government.
Tell us about Nancy Pelosi's managers and the kinds of arguments we're going to hear from them without testimony being given beforehand.
I think that they will be pushing, obviously, for the testimony of the individuals we've talked about, and I sure hope that they push for the testimony of Donald Trump as part of that. But I do think, and this was the central argument of my book, that you don't need, strictly speaking, all of these witnesses and documents because you have the president himself outlining the case in the transcript with the Ukrainian president on July 25th. And so I suspect, you know, if I'm one of those seven folks, this isn't a very hard case to present. It's pretty simple and the facts are there. And you do have all of these brave witnesses who came forward in the House despite the president's gag order. These were Trump administration people and Ambassador Sondland and Dr. Fiona Hill and the like, all coming forward and saying, yeah, what happened here was a real, real problem. And so you've got a lot of witnesses from the Trump administration itself that testify to this. And then, of course, you now have the GAO determination that the president broke the law, broke his oath.
And what will the arguments from the Republicans be?
You know, I think what they're really trying to do is the three monkeys defense of, you know, trying to block the witnesses and documents from coming forward so they can see no evil and hear no evil. I think once you look into the actual facts and allegations, it's a really hard defense, Diane. I mean, I think I'm a pretty good lawyer. I don't know exactly how to defend this on the actual facts. I mean, they could say, well, we like Trump because of his judges and his economic policy or something like that. But in terms of this behavior, the president going and trying to seek out help to cheat in the 2020 election, and not just from anyone, but from a foreign government, is, you know, pretty much the height of terrible and unconstitutional behavior. And as I say in the book, apart from all the legal issues, what it did is it gave the Ukrainian government massive blackmail potential over Donald Trump, because when Trump did this, he tried to do it in secret, and the only folks who knew about it were the Ukrainians. And so the Ukrainians had massive leverage over him, and they could have said to him for the next several years, had the plot not been revealed by this whistleblower, they could have said, hey, give us more aid, give us billions of dollars in aid, otherwise we'll reveal what you tried to do and tried to extort us. That is the last thing you want to happen for any government official, let alone our most powerful government official.
It sounds as though you are saying that the attorneys who are going to be arguing for Donald Trump's case are really going to be appealing as much to the senators in that room as they are to the American public for Donald Trump's reelection. If they have such a weak case, isn't that what they're going to be pushing for?
They're going to have multiple audiences, both the prosecution and the defense. It's the 100 senators in the room, for sure, but it's also the American public watching on television. So that's a second audience. And then the third audience is the audience of history and how folks, historians and scholars and ordinary folks will look back on these episodes and ask whether impartial justice was done. And, you know, I'm an optimist, and I do think that our founders are right to think that things like institutions like the Congress and things like oaths make a difference, things like the Chief Justice presiding. And I think that, you know, the Senate yesterday was transformed into a different tribunal, one that is sitting as a court of impeachment. And I maintain hope that in that solemn setting, truth can emerge, that the facts can come out. And I think if truth emerges and the facts come out, there's only one conclusion for the senators to reach, which is Donald Trump committed high crimes and misdemeanors. He has to be removed from office, and he has to be barred from the privilege of future office holding in the United States.
Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Kenny Pirog and Natalie Yurev-Livker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.